Woodworkers for the Blind presents George Wurzel, a professional woodworker, a.k.a. the Subaru guy. A little bit rustic and a little bit curmudgeon-y. And you can find Woodworkers for the Blind on the web at www4b.org. A lot of blind and visually impaired woodworkers sharing ideas, thoughts, projects, and a lot of how-to-dos. And now our host, Daryl Vickers, will take it away.
This guy came by and bought two of them. And then 2 weeks later, he came back and he bought 100 of them. And that's really what put me into the woodworking business. In the third grade, I started at the Michigan School for the Blind residential school. So went from living at home where mom did your chores for you to going to a residential school for the blind where you had to do all your own chores. It just wasn't fair. This old antique wooden biscuit cutter. She says, can you make one of these? So I went downstairs and I made her up an example of it. They don't sell for a lot of money. They're 30 bucks a piece, but I have sold a couple thousand of them, you know?
All right. Good evening, everybody. This is Daryl. This is our July chat call with Mr. George Wurzel. This is our first anniversary call, actually, because believe it or not, it's been a year since we started doing these, and George was our first guest.
Aww.
And of course, back then, it was up to me to record it, and that didn't turn out so good. So we're doing George again. He's always worth having again anyway. This time, we have someone else doing the controlling, so it will be recorded for everybody. So how are you, Mr. George?
I am doing just about fine. It's a little warm down here in Tennessee. We could use a little of that rain they had up there in Minnesota. It's a little dry, too.
Yeah, it's kind of been a little different everywhere, I think. Yeah. Mr. Jeff, you on here too, sir?
Yes, sir.
All right. So, George, I'm going to ask you to give us your background of how long you've been without sight and so forth.
Came out of the womb with really bad vision. Never saw well enough to read any kind of standard print. Don't know if I ever really saw well enough to recognize faces or anything. If you start off with really, really bad eyes, you do many other things to compensate to know who people are as far as voice goes, smell goes, height goes, mannerisms go, and all those kinds of things. So I'm not really sure if I ever had the ability to recognize people. I don't know. Started off going to a regular school system for kindergarten and first and second grade. And then some wise person convinced my mom and dad that our best spot to be would be at the Michigan School for the Blind. So in the third grade, I started at the Michigan School for the Blind, which was a residential school. So went from living at home where mom did your chores for you to going to a residential school for the blind where you had to do all your own chores. It just wasn't fair. In the time that I was at the school for the blind, I probably considered it to be more like going to a reform school. It was relatively strict and it was very regimented because you had 375 kids there. You got to run a system that everybody can work within. So it wasn't until probably many years after being out of the school for the blind that I got to realize what a true asset that school for the blind was. And one of the things that if you talk to old goats like me who've gone to residential schools for the blind, they will tell you that one of the things they got out of the residential school for the blind that kids don't get today is the fact that you got to see that your blindness didn't necessarily form who you were near as much as the type of person you were formed who you were, because you had at the school for the blind where I was, you know, you had 350, 375 other blind kids there. So you got to look around and say, you know, I'm not very good in English, but that girl over there, she's amazing in English, but she can't find her way across the street. And I had incredibly good mobility skills and knew where I was and knew how to find places. And directions were always part of my life. I always knew which way was north and everything. And then mechanical issues. There was kids who you could tell them 500 times, lefty, loosey, righty, tighty. And they still, every time they picked up a screwdriver or a wrench, they had a hard time trying to remember which way to tighten things and loosen things. How to take things apart and put things back together escapes a lot of people's comprehensions, sighted people, blind people involved. I mean, I have some friends who have perfectly good vision. If it wasn't for GPS, they would still be lost somewhere in the world because their directionality is just horrible. So, and the school for the blind had a lot of different choices that kids today in residential schools just plain don't get. We had several trade school things going on at the School for the Blind. You could leave the School for the Blind and become immediately employed. General Motors, Chrysler, and the main one, Oldsmobile, always came to our job fairs and presented. I have a lot of friends who immediately out of high school went to work for one of the big three. And those were really good paying jobs. I mean, it was some of the best blue collar paying jobs, you know, in the country at the time. And I'm old, so this was back in the early 70s. So as far as things that I had advantage of was wood shop, metal shop, chair caning, piano technology, small engine repair, automobile repair. When I left the School for the Blind, I was a certified Volkswagen mechanic right out of high school. I mean, I'm not even out of high school. As a junior in high school, I became a certified VW mechanic. I could walk into a Volkswagen dealership and present my paperwork and immediately had some help and people saying, this guy really must know something about what he's doing because, you know, here he's passed the certification. And the VW certification was pretty tough back then. I mean, it was, if you became a certified VW mechanic, if you were working at a dealership, you probably had, over the course of 2 or 3 years to become certified, you probably had 100 hours of training that you went to that Volkswagen, you know, put together that we did through Volkswagen right at the School for the Blind. So came out, was a Volkswagen mechanic, very rapidly figured out I didn't like getting dirty, grimy, grubby, cold, wet, and everything. I was working one time in the wintertime, working on a car at the dealership. The guy brought the car in. It was wintertime. The service manager says, this car needs to be fixed right now. And I said, yeah, I'll get to it in a while. And he goes, no, it's a friend of the boss's. It's got to be fixed right now. So I went and worked on this car. It was the middle of the winter. It was dripping and grime and crud all down my arms. And I tell people that, you know, it was running down the backs of your arms all the way through into the top of your boots, you know, and it was horrible and icky, cruddy, salty, and just miserable, cold, wet. It was the last job of the day. I took the paperwork up to the counter and threw it down on the service desk. And I says, I'm done. He goes, well, that's the last one for the job today. And I said, no, you don't understand. I'm done. When I leave tonight, I'm packing up my tools. I'm going home and I ain't coming back except for my check. With the exception of doing it for some fun and some, you know, other things and for friends and everything, I pretty much ended my Volkswagen career right there. And I was looking for something to do that wasn't wet and dirty. And I had a friend who was a wooden boat builder, started hanging out at his place a little bit, helping him build some boats, which was kind of fun. He built fairing design, which is the Viking style ships designs, lapstrake design out of Norway. He went to Norway and apprenticed under a boat builder over there. And was building some beautiful handmade sailboats. I mean, they were just absolutely stunning. And so I worked with him a little, and a guy came in the shop one day and says, I need some showcases for my new store I'm putting in. Chip, the guy I was working with, he says, I don't have time to do that, but George, he can build them for you, not a problem. And so after the guy left, I said to Chip, I says, you know, I don't know how to build a showcase. And he says, you know, it's just a wooden box with glass on three sides. And I thought, okay. Build a wooden box and put glass on three sides. So that's what I did. And then I was playing around with another friend of mine, building a little bit of wooden lawn furniture and putting it out in the front yard for sale, building these really kind of interesting old style folding canvas wood chairs and put them out in the front yard for sale. A guy came by and bought two, which was a really big sale. Most people were buying one at a time. You know, this guy came by and bought two of them. And then 2 weeks later, he came back and he bought 100 of them. And that's really what put me into the woodwork. Business. Proceeded from there, you know, forward. I bought a joiner and a radio alarm saw on my brother's charge card from Sears and proceeded to get started in the woodworking business. And some of the very first things I did, you know, was commercial work, which kind of led me into the architectural millwork business. Another friend of mine, you know, his brother was starting a dental lab. He made bridges and false teeth and crowns and all that kind of stuff. And he needed someone to build all the cabinetry for him for his dental lab. So that was one of my first commercial jobs. I did that. And then after that, another dentist office was expanding and I did some work for them. And then I got hooked up with a confectioner store called Benjamin Twiggs Cherry Products. They sold cherry products and fudges and candies and all kinds of different things. And I got hooked up with them and I did five of their stores for them, one right after the other. There's a thing on Facebook right now I'm trying to remember the exact name. It's Old Saloons, Bars, and Taverns, something like that. There's people who submit pictures to this and information about old bars and that around the United States. And one of their criteria for being able to put something up on their site, a bar up on their site, it has to be at least 50 years old. I'm an old guy. I got one that's right at this. Right, so right now, I think it's 49 years old because we built that in the middle of the summer. So it's at 49 years old. I may fudge it a little bit and turn my pictures in of this really cool bar. It's big. It's 50 some feet long. It's a what I call a double L. It's two L-shaped bars that join together on the short legs of the L in the middle. And it's a pretty cool bar. I'm very proud of that bar. It was one of my first really big, it was my first really big bar. Did storefronts, bank teller lines, restaurant, lots and lots of restaurant work, lots of waitress stations, lots of bus stations, decorative, you know, areas, seating areas and different things, fancy wine racks. Did a huge amount of that stuff for the hospitality industry. And then when they built a new mall in our town, moved right from one store to the other, and we did five stores in the mall, did some aspect of them, either just some interior work, or in the case of a few of them, we did the total front facade that faced out into the mall and built all the fixtures and everything that went into the stores. It's the beginning of my journey. In 1982, interest rates had creeped up to over 20%. I had just secured a loan at the bank just before that had happened to build a brand new finishing department on my shop. I built a 1,500 square foot finishing and storage area on the end of my shop. And right when the interest rates went up, and then everybody quit buying anything, and I went broke, went bankrupt. I lost my building, lost my shop, lost, you know, all my tools, started right back again at absolutely zero. Trying to figure out what to do. I loaded up all my belongings on a Greyhound bus and moved from Traverse City, Michigan to Hickory, North Carolina. I went to college at Catawba Valley Technical College to get a degree in furniture production management. Originally was only going to be in Hickory for somewhere around 18 months. And then my plan when I went there was that after I graduated from there, I was going to go back to Michigan and try to find, you know, some sort of job in the furniture industry. I was a little slow. It took me about 16 years to get out of North Carolina. And when I was there, I worked in many different aspects of the furniture industry. I got hired to build a kitchen cabinet manufacturing plant from scratch. I was the head engineer. We built a European style flatline plant, like a IKEA style furniture, all the European hardware and everything. No face frames, all frameless stuff. Built that from scratch, got it up, got it running. And I went in and I wanted a raise because I had proven what I could do. And we were putting product out the door. We had our first week in the black. We put out more product than, you know, it cost us to operate 1 week. So I decided it was time to tell them I wanted more money, and they wouldn't give me any more money. So I quit. You know, George is kind of pigheaded sometimes, trying to figure out what to do with my newfound freedom and no job. So I was fussing around working for a friend of mine, doing some part-time sales, selling router bits for a friend of mine who manufactured router bits in Hickory. His business eventually was gobbled up by Whiteside. Whiteside bought him out. So what I worked for when I was him wasn't Whiteside, but it eventually became a part of Whiteside. When that was slowing down, I was trying to figure out what to do. My mom stopped to see me on her way to Florida. I had my father's internment flag laying on the coffee table in my living room. I was cleaning some stuff up and repacking some stuff. And she says to me, she says, "I can't believe you've been in the woodworking business for most of your life and you've never made a nice wooden box to put that flag in. That's shameful. Only the way a mom could properly shame you." The very next morning, I got up really, really early, probably like 4 o'clock in the morning. And I went out into my little shop in the garage that I had, and I built a really nice wooden box to put my dad's veterans internment flag in, and brought it in and showed my mom what I did. And she said, "Oh, what a good boy you are." Gave me a kiss on the cheek and went on her way to Florida. A couple days later, my neighbor stops with his brother-in-law, and they're in my house. We're sitting there having an adult beverage of some sort. And the guy looks over and he goes, "Is that a box for a veterans internment flag?" And he goes, "Yeah." I said, "Yeah, that's exactly what it is." He says, "Where'd you get that?" And I said, "I made it." He says, "This is really weird." He says, "But my brother owns a funeral home, and he asked me just last week where he get some boxes to put veterans internment flags in. We got some remains coming back from Vietnam, guys that, you know, got left over there who they found, they identified, they're bringing them back, and they're gonna have a ceremony, and he wants boxes to put the veterans internment flags in." He says, "Can you make some?" I says, "Absolutely." He goes, Well, let's go see my brother and show him this case. So we jump in the car and we go up to the funeral home. I haven't even sat down in the guy's office, and the guy looks over at it and he goes, that's a box for a flag, right? And I said, yeah. And he says, I want six of them. I says, when do you want them? He says, in 2 weeks. So I turned around and left his office, went back and produced the boxes for him. And then I rented some shop space for a friend of mine. And I produced 100 boxes and started doing a little bit of marketing and everything. And within a very short period of time, I far exceeded my ability to manufacture them. So I subcontracted out the manufacturing of my veterans internment flag boxes to a small manufacturing plant called Dr. Grabo Pipe Company. They were in the pipe business, and they were also in business for building all kinds of displays for one of the big liquor companies, but I don't remember which one. I started doing that. I was pretty successful at it. I had 2,500 accounts coast to coast, and I landed a contract with the U.S. Air Force and the U.S. Army almost simultaneously to produce some flag boxes for them. I didn't have enough money to produce the product. I was looking for an investor. I found a guy who I thought was going to be my sugar daddy, and we got right down to the last negotiation day, and he said, I've decided I don't want to invest in your company, but I'll buy it from you. So I sold him my little flag box business to him. And a couple of years later, there was an article in the Hickory newspaper in Hickory, North Carolina. He had sold over 1 million of these flag boxes that I had designed. So that's definitely my most successful product that I've ever done in my whole life. Got a sweet little check, was kind of a bum for a while, had a girlfriend at the time who owned a couple bakeries. So I played and worked in the bakeries, learned how to bake bread and make cheesecakes, and worked in the deli part of the business for a little bit, and got restless, ended up going back to Michigan and started a kitchen cabinet operation, selling kitchen cabinets and manufacturing Corian countertops, plastic laminate countertops, butcher countertops, and started up a business that was basically countertop and installation, kitchen cabinet installation business. And did that for probably about 8 years. And then in 2004, 2005, the economy in the state of Michigan started to crash again. And I said, I've seen this happen before. So my guy, Josh, who worked for me, was my main guy in the shop one day. I said to him, I said, Josh, I think it's time to throw in the hat and go move on and go to something different. Things are slowing down. I don't want to owe a bunch of people a bunch of money. I'm getting out. So I got out of the kitchen cabinet operation, and I went to work running a kids camp for blind kids in Michigan called Camp Tush Ma Hita, which is touch, smell, hear, and taste put together into one word. And I did that for Sharon, and I did that for about 5 years, 6 years, until there was no money left in the state of Michigan. This would have been about 2010 or so. There just wasn't any money. So the camp property itself, physical plant, was all owned by the state of Michigan, what was left of the old Michigan School for the Blind. So we just gave it back to them, and I got an offer from Blind Inc. in Minneapolis. Jeff had abandoned his position there as the woodworking teacher, and they hired me to take his place. Those were big shoes to fill, but I managed to do it. I succeeded. And I lasted there about 2.5 years before I got sideways with management, which was not hard to do with that, with that particular time there. So went from there, got hired by San Francisco Lighthouse for the Blind out in San Francisco at their camp up in Napa, California, up on top of Mount Veeder. Went up there, restored an old 1920s grape crushing barn to be a big wood shop and teaching facility with a gallery. And it was on its way to having a pottery studio and a leather studio on the lower level as well. And that's where my relationship with WW4B started. We started running workshops for WW4B, and we ran workshops for San Francisco Lighthouse. And some people attended multiples of those that I had done, but not just the WW4B ones, but the ones that were run as a part of Enchanted Hills Camp for the Blind. And that's my relationship with WW4B got started. And that's why we're here talking today.
That's right.
I got to take a drink.
That's one thing I like about talking to George. I don't have to do much. But that is where I first met you. And I think that must go back to about 14, 15, 16, 2000, something like that.
Yep.
And it was a nice facility there that they had. Mr. Caddick still had it.
I wish they did too. You know, after the fire, and that's kind of what ended the whole thing. They lost all their housing and everything there.
Yeah.
Now they're getting their act back together again. But I was the art program. I was it. I was all of it. And they have never yet hired someone back to replace me. And I wish they would. I wish they'd find some person. And they need to find some, you know, 30 or 40-year-old to go in there and put together another big program for them so we can... Lots of people need the opportunity to do what we offered people to be able to do, to learn. It's really important to learn from, as a blind person anyways, it's so much easier to learn from somebody who's blind, who already is doing what you want to do, than to get some person who's sighted, who knows what you want to do, but is so limited by their prejudice towards you being blind and them thinking you can't do it because they couldn't do it if their eyes were closed. And that's really hard to do a good job teaching under that system. You know, there are a few really good teachers out there that I've run into who have normal vision, who do an incredible job, you know, teaching blind people. Jerry Kermode, who we just stumbled across accidentally, who was the guy who ran a big turning program we had there one week, and we had 6 or 7 lathes set up, and Jerry came and helped me run that. I mean, that man figured it out. He spent a lot of time standing in his lathe before he came and did that, turning with his eyes closed, you know, and sharpening his tools with his eyes closed and figuring out what kinds of things you needed to do. Just tweak just a little bit to make it work just a little bit better. At the School for the Blind, when I was there, my favorite teacher was a totally blind teacher. His name of the guy, Mr. Rosnowski, Mr. R. But Mr. Anderson, who taught the woodshop program, he was a sighted guy, but he really understood what it took to teach blind people. And that's because that's all he did was teach blind people. So he learned by accident, you know, what it took, you know.
Well, right. Yeah. It's you know, it's different. And that's one thing I wanted to bring out on this call, George, is that you now have your whole shop and part of your gallery in Tennessee and Ginkgo Gallery in, well, never can remember the name. What's the town, George?
Greenville, Tennessee.
Greenville, Tennessee, right.
Yeah.
And George offers classes. So a lot of times I get asked about classes or how to get started. And I would suggest one good way is to get a hold of you, because you've done it and you have the facility for it. That is right there about 99% of the battle, is finding a spot. And then a person, if you can find a blind person to teach you, like George was explaining it, it's just easier because they understand the whole thing.
David Lau, who is just here, he came and spent a weekend, you know, and he wanted to learn how to make box joints. And he'd ask a couple different people about, you know, making box joints, which is, in my opinion, is one of the simpler, really good joints that can be made. They've been around forever and ever and ever and ever. They're really strong. They were considered to be an industrial joint probably most of their lives. Now they're kind of a cool decorative joint, you know, because they're really exposed on the corner, and it makes this really nice kind of stacked checkerboard pattern up the corner of the boxes and everything.
Right.
He'd ask some people about how to do that, and they couldn't figure out how to teach them how to do it. And that's one of the simplest joints there is to teach how to make. You know, I almost think that I could talk someone through it over the phone. You know, it's that easy to do.
It's easy to make the joint. It just takes practice to get 4 of them to look really pretty. That's what I found. You know, 4 corners to look pretty.
And the key is, you know, how do you build a good jig that won't let you make errors? That's the big thing. You know, build a jig that won't let you make a mistake. That's the key to making a good box joint.
Yep, that's very true. Yep. Follow you. George has a Facebook page that you can follow him on. There's another something that you left out, and Facebook is what brought it back to me. So you actually have kind of 2 handles on Facebook, and one of them is George the Subaru Guy. And tell us about George the Subaru Guy, because it's a big story.
Purely just right place at the right time, and answered the phone and didn't hang up on the guy. And they're making a national ad, and a national agency is doing it. The person who designs the ad, you know, makes their presentation to whoever the company is and said, you know, do you like what, you know, we designed for you to, you know, for you to sell your product? And the manufacturer, in this case, Subaru, says, oh my God, we love this. Yeah, we want to go to them. But then the advertising agency is tasked, you know, with making it come to fruition because it's their idea, you know. So they send out to all the agencies, they send out a request for, you know, people to meet the criteria for their ad. And the qualification or the specifications for the person they were looking at for the Subaru ad is they were looking for a blind gentleman between the ages of 55 and 75, somewhat rustic and a little bit curmudgeonly.
Oh, that's you perfectly.
Yeah. There are a lot of blind people out in the world who have agents, who've done ads, who've done things like on MythBusters and been on, you know, TV programs and that kind of stuff, you know, we're blind. So they all got agents. And so this request goes out to all the agencies. And the first thing they do, you know, the agents, they go through their list, say, who do I have that's blind, you know, that fits you. So they start calling up all the people they have. All the blind people I know who have agents are all corporate types. You know, they're all suit and tie, work for Apple or work for Google or work for, right, you know, a residential teaching program or something like that. So they all said, no, no, that's not me. That's not me. Call George Wurtzel. So after five different people said, call George Wurtzel, they call George Wurtzel. And I answer the phone and he says, my name is so-and-so. And he says, we're doing a Subaru ad and we're looking for a blind person for this ad. And I said, yeah, right. And he's, no, 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 don't hang up. Because you know, I was just ready to push the button. I thought, either someone is jerking my chain or someone's just, you know, crank calling me or whatever, you know. So he goes into his little spiel about what they're trying to do. And then the ad agency truly had written an ad with a, you know, with a blind person in it. I said to him, the very first thing I said to him, I says, if it's some sappy thing that makes a blind person look like they're disabled, handicapped, or need sympathy, I says, I'm not interested at all, period. He goes, no, that's not anything like that whatsoever. He read me the script for the ad. And I said, well, that sounds like a pretty cool ad. That's certainly not exploitive, in my opinion, any stretch of the imagination. No one's dragging me around by the hand or anything, you know. So they call you up. You used to have to go to a hotel or somewhere. So they'd bring everybody in, and everybody would do a little screen test thing at the hotel and, you know, walk around and, you know, pose for everybody. Now they do it all via FaceTime. They call you up. They send you a little script ahead of time and they say, read your lines, you know, and you read your lines to them. They stand up, sit down, turn around, look this way, look that way, look up, look down, back away from the camera, you know, walk towards the camera. After all that's done, they say, well, we'll get back to you, you know, in a couple of weeks when we make up our minds, you know, what we're going to do. We have some other people we're talking to. And just as I'm ready to push the hang up button, I hear some guy way back in the background, just barely could hear him say, that's our guy. Oh, that's cool. I might end up doing an ad. So the ad happened to be in California. I'm certain that where I was really didn't have a lot to do with ending up in it. But anyways, they set up a time and you go and you make this ad. It was really cool. It's still mind-boggling to me that they had 100 people working, or really close to that, 90-some people working for 3 days to make a 60-second ad. That just seems insane. That's just, how can you piss away that much time making a 60-second ad? You know? But they, you know, the result is what you saw on TV, you know, and they chop it down and chop it down and chop it down until they got everything that they want to fit in that little 60-second window. And then they actually made a 30-second version of it as well. They made a short version of it. And so that's my 15 minutes of fame in 60-second increments.
You do that while you were at Enchanted Hills?
I did, yeah. I took 3 days of vacation time to go do that ad, so I got paid. I double dipped for those days because they pay you the days during when they shoot, they pay you. The other funny thing about that happened is that blind people who don't see pictures of me don't know. But for the last probably 25 years of my life, at least, my daily clothing allotment has been bib overalls and flannel shirt or a T-shirt and a big straw hat. I mean, that's what I've worn for at least the last 25 years. So we show up for doing the wardrobing for this ad. They get all your sizes from you ahead of time, and they have a tailor right with them. They can modify anything they want. I want to say I tried on at least 20 different groupings of clothing, different pants, different shirts, different hats, different jackets and everything. And after this went on for a couple hours, the guy says, okay, we're going to look at all the pictures and we're going to make a decision on what we're going to do for you for wardrobing. And so this was taking place at a Holiday Inn. I says, you done with me? Yeah, we're done with you. So, you know, tell you later what, you know, what you're going to wear. And so I walk down to the bar and I'm sitting there drinking a beer and the guy comes walking up. He goes, you know, I looked at everything that we had you try on today. And he goes, there's nothing better that fits your particular persona or, you know, body type or any better than what you're wearing right now. So I wore my own clothes in the ad. I wore my bib overalls and my flat shirt. And it was pretty funny. So they really did portray me as me. And people who hung around with me and that have been around me in most of my, I do have an incredibly good sense of direction. If you ask me where to go somewhere, if I've ever been there, I can get you back there. So me giving instructions to those people where to go in the Subaru app, people who've known me all my life, just, oh my God, that's, how did you get that? I mean, that's just all you. I mean, because that's,
right.
I'm always telling people where to go, where to drive, you know.
Well, that's pretty cool. So tell us about your current shop that you have.
Thanks to Subaru, when the buyers came along at Enchanted Hills, I had a pocket full of cash. So I decided that them and I were going to go separate directions. California was, I looked around there and it was just way too expensive. Whatever I was going to do there was going to take every penny I had. If you weren't successful, where was I going to leave you? You know, so I started looking around. I lived in Hickory, North Carolina for 16 years. So I was very familiar with the climate and the western end of North Carolina and the eastern end of Tennessee. And I really liked it here. The climate is beautiful. The mountains are wonderful. Lots of recreation, waterfalls, hiking. And it's just kind of a nice little laid back corner of the country. And it's affordable. My criteria was pretty specific. As a blind guy, there was some certain things that I really, really, they were absolute musts for where I was going to end up. A number one, had to be someplace walkable. A number two, had to be able to get to a grocery store, had to be able to get to the bank, get to the doctor's office and all that on yourself independently. You know, I didn't want to have to be somewhere, you know, where you had to try to find a ride to go anywhere to do the things you wanted to do. I wanted something that had, you know, some kind of foot traffic, you know, so that people, you know, could actually find you. I didn't want to be totally tucked away on a back alley somewhere. And something maybe with a little bit of a tourist base to it, because then you have a continual influx of, you know, newer people. So this particular building that we bought is right on one of the main east-west streets. It had been abandoned for 6 years when we bought it. So my shop is the two-thirds of the lower level of my building. My building is 6,500 square feet. About 2,200 square feet of the lower level of my building is my shop. And it's got two big walkout doors that open up. So you got a 7 foot wide by 7 foot tall opening out onto a parking lot where you can drive a forklift right into the lower level of my building. My shop is a little crowded because of the amount of equipment I have. I have three table saws, a 24-inch planer, a 16-inch joiner, 42-inch wide belt sander, time saver sander. I've got six lathes, three drill presses, a mortiser, another 12-inch joiner and 12-inch planer, a rolling panel table saw, panel saw that's up against the wall for handling sheet goods, you know, vertically, lumber racks, rolling carts. It's a really nice working space. 9'6" ceilings. The only thing that it has in it that I don't like is the fact that it was built to be a creamery. And they had all kinds of industrial machinery on the second floor above me. So the distance between the posts going one way in my basement are 10 foot on center, going the other way in my basement are 12 foot on center. So there's a lot of columns in my basement. So if you're going to turn around a 16 foot board in my basement, you have to thread the needle just a little bit to be able to spin a 16 footer.
So do you guys live in the building?
Yeah, the lower level of the building is grade level. You walk out on grade level on the southwest corner, and on the upper level of the building, it's grade level on the northeast corner. So it sits diagonally into the corner of a hill. We are in the mountains, so there is nothing flat in this town. So you can walk into the upper level of my building, you know, through my gallery. My gallery right now is a little gallery. It's only 12 feet by 16 feet, somewhere's in there. And we got it slam dam full of stuff. And then our living quarters is, again, about the 15 and a half, 16 feet wide by 50 feet deep. And that has our living area and our kitchen. And then we have above the gallery, there's a bedroom that's actually on the third floor of the building. And then in the back corner of the building, over top of part of where my shop area is, I'm building out a master bedroom that will have a big walk-in shower and everything back there. And it'll be bedroom bathroom that's about 14 feet by 30 feet. That'll be the master bed and master bathroom back there. And if I live long enough, I'll put a deck on the back of my building that you'll walk out of from the back side of my building from the kitchen and out of the master bedroom.
That all sounds really nice. And I'm glad you explained all that and also about the town, because I hope one day these days, not too far in the near future, that we can maybe get a workshop there.
Well, I want to do that.
But I hope when people listen, you understand that, you know, logistically, we would have to get from the airport to George. But
yeah.
With the hotel and everything that's right there, it's everything is centrally located. I mean, a blind guy is telling you all, you know, that he lives here. He knows how to get around.
And for people who don't want to go too far after class, if you walk out of the front door of a building and you turn to the right and you walk exactly 40 feet, you are at Rock City Tap and Lounge, where they have 18 beers on draft. So
what more did you do ask for, right?
What more could you ask for?
This is Scott. For the last several months, I've been working on how to get down there to see George and take a class. I am going to make it, and this description has made me even more determined. So I'll be seeing you within the next few months, George.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
I am very hopeful that we can get something together for next year. It won't make it this year, but next year I hope we can get something going there. I do think it's an excellent solution. The number one thing is having a place, you know,
yep,
that accommodate a few people. Not, you know, we can't do 100 people, or we can do, you know, 6 to 12 maybe.
Absolutely, you can do that. Yep.
This would be a great facility. Also, I hope everybody who, if you're not on the call, listens to this call. George has made a living doing woodworking, which is another thing that comes up all the time, or sometimes anyway. Can you make a living? And you know you can. It's like everything else. You just have to commit to it and work hard.
Some things, my little flag case business, I mean, that was just something I just stumbled into, that figured out, you know, that there was a market and figured out how to exploit that market, how to use that market. Since I've been here, it's tapered off now in the last, you know, year or so. But during COVID, when COVID came along, was trying to figure out, you know, what to do. And Sharon came up with this crazy idea. She says, we live down south now, and everybody down here makes biscuits. And she had this old antique wooden biscuit cutter that she had rolling around in a box for, you know, 30 or 40 years. And she says, can you make one of these? Can you make these? So I went downstairs and I made her up an example of it. And it took me a little while. I probably made 30 or 40 of them before I really figured out a good system on how to make them. They don't sell for a lot of money. They're $30 a piece. But I have sold a couple thousand of them, you know.
I have bought one.
Yeah, there you go. See? And Jeff's bought a couple, you know. So that little thing there, I mean, it's tapered off now. Everybody cooking at home thing that happened during COVID backed way off. You know, we sell 5 to 10 a week anyways, still almost consistently. When I first started having my little gallery here, there was 3 galleries here in town. There was one called Art Space that had like 4 or 5 different artists that did an artist co-op. And right beside that was another lady who was a turner, who did ink pens and small things. And her husband is a woodworker and did some bandsaw boxes and some different stuff. And they were, you know, a block away. And then we had a world-class glass blower who was like 6 blocks. Mm-hmm. All 3 of those places have gone away in the last year. And we used to always send people back and forth to each other. You know, have you been over to Art Space? Have you been, you know, to see Denise? Have you been over to the glass gallery, you know, glass blower? That whole thing has gone away. And that has really, really hurt my little gallery business.
Mm-hmm.
I'm right now trying to figure out, never worked hard at trying to be a, you know, an electronic marketer. How do you sell stuff over the internet? And I'm thinking right now seriously about, you know, how can I expand that better? And I'm also looking out into different communities and maybe become part of someone else's gallery somewhere else to sell my stuff, you know, because it certainly has just come to a crashing halt.
I think a lot of things like that do, though. They don't kind of come in waves, I think, you know. All you need is just a couple of people that love the area to start doing the same thing again, and everything will be right back.
Yeah, that's right. And the teaching thing is on again, off again. It's a little better during the winter than it is during the summer. We've got three or four people lined up, you know, to come take classes in the next couple of weeks. So that aspect of it plugs along at a pretty even pace. 90% of my students have been, you know, people who see.
Right. But, you know, you have a nice facility there.
I get some good national recognition for my relationship with Rikon Tools. So I work their shows for them. I'm their booth babe at their shows. I turn for them at their shows. And that gets me some national exposure. I have been fortunate enough to be in a couple national magazines. I made it in Fine Woodworking Magazine 2 years ago now. When that magazine came out 50 years ago, I joked with some friends of mine who worked for me at the time in my old shop that someday I'm going to be in that magazine. It only took me 50 years, but I got there.
That's right. You got there, though, huh? I want to ask you a personal question with Sharon. How long have you and Sharon been together? Are you guys married? Or
25 years.
Oh, so she's not somebody new then, huh, George? I'm going to open this up for some questions. Yeah. George is a great person to ask questions. I mean, you could tell George he's probably done it if you wanted to know how to do something. And he's done it as, you know, a blind person. Also, one quick thing, a note on the website, when you people register, there is a little checkbox on that website that says, do you want to share your contact info with others, members, not the whole world, but other members. And I'm pretty sure George has shared his info there. So if you want to contact him, you can always do it through the list. But if you wanted to find it, you can go there to find him. Is that right, George? You remember that or not?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, WW4B questions all the time, so.
When people log in, besides the magazine recording, the other thing that's hidden back behind that firewall is all of us who wanted to share our information. So that's usually where you can find just about anybody. If they put their stuff out there, then they don't mind you contacting them. I assume at least that's how I am. So I'm going to open it up for some questions. I also, before I forget, I want to really thank you again for taking the time to be on here. And I'm sure we have it recorded this time. And if we don't, it is not my fault.
Well, you can blame it on Jeff now, though. See.
That's right. I got somebody else to blame it on. It won't all fall to me, but I really do thank you, George.
Not a problem.
You're an easy interview to do.
I got a question for you, George.
Yes, sir.
If someone is interested in some turning classes out in Greenville, Tennessee with George at the Ginkgo Gallery, well, how would they find out more information about that?
Call me up. It's the easiest way. If you're going to come here from far away, you're probably not going to take my introduction to wood turning. It's called Turn a Bowl class, Make a Bowl class. It's my cheapest thing I do. It's $85, takes about 3 to 3.5 hours. You come in, the piece of wood's already mounted on the lathe, and I walk you through hand over hand, almost from start to finish, how to make a bowl. When you leave, you have a bowl, and you have somewhat of an idea what it is to turn. Did you learn how to mount stuff on the lathe? No. Did you learn to do a tool selection? No. Did you learn how to do finish selection? No, because all that was predetermined before you walked in the door. But you do walk out the door with a finished product, a finished bowl that you can be proud of, you know. And my next step up from that is my introduction to getting started and turning. And that's a 2-day class, and it's $375. It's for one or two people at that price. So if you want to bring a friend and do it for that price, it's a heck of a deal. If you add a third person, you add half the price. You know, again, if you add a fourth person, you actually have to add half the price again, because it starts being more complicated when you have more people. If you only have two people, you got some free time. When you get more people, then you don't have the free time. So the best deal is the two people. For the first thing you'll do is start off making a spindle, a really thin spindle, a really long, thin spindle, which wants to chatter and jump and move around and snap and break and all those kinds of things. And that's what I start you off on, because what I want you to do is develop some really good hand control, some really good tool control, understand, you know, what the difference, you know, when you start pushing that tool against the wood, how much pressure it takes to cut and how much pressure it starts to deform, how you keep your tool level. If you raise the back of your tool up too much and the end of that tool sneaks in underneath that spindle, it snaps that spindle off, boom, it's gone. You start over again. So that's what we start you with. And then we teach you a little bit about how to put stuff on the lathe. When do I want to use a faceplate? When do I want to use a tenon in a chuck? When do I want to use a mortise in the chuck? When do I want to turn between centers? when do I want to turn on a screw mandrel? We work you through all of those things and give you a little bit of taste of why those different things work different ways. We start you off with a spindle, so you have a little idea of spindle work. Then we'll go to doing a bowl or a plate. We don't get into the big hollow forms because that's the next class up, but we'll work you into making a bowl or a plate so you learn to turn inside and outside. And then we'll run you through what it takes to make a pretty piece. You know, what kind of time is it going to take me to sand out the tears that I got in there? We always try to find you, a pretty piece of wood. So when you're done with the 2-day class, most people have 2 to 3 projects, sometimes 4 projects, depending on what their particular skill level is and that. And those are things you get to take home with them. If you are happy with the chunks of wood that I give you, there's no extra charge for materials. If we get into, you want to use a pretty piece of spalted maple or a fancy piece of curly walnut or something, then we do upcharge you for the wood that you use. That's a great spot to start. And then if you want to customize a class, if you come to me and say, I want to learn to make style and rail doors, I'll set you up a class. We'll start right at the beginning. We'll walk you all the way through making a style and rail door. You're going to have to warn me 3 weeks in advance if you want to use a lock miter joint, because that's how long it takes to set that thing up. So if you ever own one of those lock miter joints and you get that thing dialed in, make sure you make yourself some setup blocks so that you, when you get ready to set that thing back up there again, you just slide your setup block up there and you raise that up until it slips right in, and then you bring the fence up until it kisses it and you're ready to go second time around.
Yes, that lock miter thing has been driving me insane. Now, Dennis was kind enough to spend a lot of time on the phone with me, walking me through that bugger. I know how to do it, but getting it done? That's another issue.
But once you get that sucker locked in, make sure you make those blocks. Those are the key to coming back and making that thing. You may just, give it the tiniest little tap with a block of wood to tweak it at the end. But, if you make yourself some good setup blocks, the second time is no frustration at all.
Right. It's getting to that second time that's sort of the issue.
Well, I will say that I have 4 lock miter bits now, but I bought that for jig lock miter bit and the half height gauge, and it really does make that part of it, like George says, once you get it you can make templates, but the first time it makes that a lot easier. I will tell you that on a lock miter bit, getting the height right is the hard part. Mm-hmm. And getting the fence part, that you can tweak that, because you can move the fence and you start out shallow and just keep making and moving it back. You could do all that stuff if you need to, but getting the height right has to be right the first time, or the joint doesn't come out. And there is where a 64th or a few thousands count in woodworking on that particular joint. Most of the time, we don't worry about numbers like that. But with that bit, you have to worry about those numbers if you want a nice joint.
Well, George, do you have a class to help people like me stop making stupid mistakes?
I've always told people there is limits to people's knowledge. There's limits to genius. There is no limits on stupidity. And I'm really sorry to tell you that.
Well, I was out in the shop earlier today working on my small box project. And I realized when I was getting into this whole thing, I realized that I made a mistake when I was cutting out my pieces and it didn't work. So I get to start over.
It's just how we learn. It's how you get better.
No one else has ever, ever done this using a click rule, is to measure something and then go over and use the wrong stop on the click rule and end up with a piece 6 inches too short.
We'd never do anything like that here.
I think when you can live with some of the mistakes, it's like you live with it, but you learn, because when you come back to making another series of these things, that's the first thing I think of. I don't think of the wood. I think of I'm not making that mistake again, and I work around it.
Yep.
You just live and learn. And I think that's part of woodworking, is experimenting, going at it, and not being afraid to do it again.
Well, that's all part of life, right? It's how we learn most things. You just do them and do them wrong until you do them right. That's all.
One of my students a couple of weeks ago making a bowl and got a little aggressive and hit the way out of the outside edge of the bowl, hit it too hard with a gouge and popped it right off. It was on a 4-jaw chuck in a mortise. It blew the edge of the mortise off. So, what to do? The lady's got her bowl 80% done, So I took and rechucked it on the outside of the, she had fortunately had a little foot on the bottom of the bowl. So rechucked it on the outside as if you were chucking it on a tenon. And then she finished turning their bowl. And then when we're done, we just took and flipped it over on the table and took some 60 grit paper on a disc sander and just ground off that whole foot and made the bottom of the bowl flat. I mean, that's, she ended up with a perfectly good looking bowl. It looks like she made it that way, you know, but it was just a case of how do you fix it? That's the big thing about woodworking. You know, I always tell people when they screw something up or something, it's just an opportunity to embellish it, to make it look a little prettier.
You know, Charles Dio used to be he passed away now, but he used to be a friend of woodwork for the blind. He always said he was a better fixer than a woodworker.
There's a professional wood turner out there gets really big money for his stuff, Michael Mode. I mean, he gets thousands of dollars for his pieces. He has this series of pieces that I think they're beautiful, but I absolutely hate them because they have a very, very small base on them, and then they have a big flare on them, you know, so you've got this 8-inch or 12-inch diameter flared piece that's sitting on a 2-inch diameter foot on the ground. So those things, if you walk by them and just look at them out of the corner of your eye, they fall over, you know. And I says, what on earth? Why do you make so many of those? He says, you wouldn't believe the amount of repair business that generates because people knock them over and send them back to me to fix them. And I think he was serious.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed the most is in your design. If you make a mistake in your design and you can live with it, and it's amazing how many people will come by and never notice anything like that. They love it and it's all, and they sell, yeah. or they, you give them away. People love them. Then you fix it and now it's fixed and you love it. And someone comes by and they don't notice the difference at all. But when you are making something and you have a mistake in it, but everyone loves it anyways, you'll never erase that out of your mind. You'll find it, you'll feel it, you'll see it, you'll touch it. It just sticks out like a unicorn, you know, just you run into it.
I was doing this national art show at the Detroit Museum of Contemporary Art back 10 years ago, maybe even longer. I had made myself this list of stuff that I was going to have in the show. And as time is clicking along, the show is getting closer. I'm looking at this list and I'm in panic mode about, oh my God, how am I ever going to do this one and do that one and everything? And then all of a sudden it was like, you know, Jeff slapped me upside the head with a 2x4 and said, pay attention. He goes, you know, you're the only one that knows how much stuff you were going to do for that show. Because I wrote it all down. This is what I'm going to do. And I had it fixed in my head. That was what was going to have to happen. And all of a sudden it got into my own head that I'm the one that made the set criteria that if I don't do one of these pieces, no one else is going to know but me. And the moment that I got that in through my head, I relaxed and started concentrating on just whatever the piece I was doing was. And by the time I got done ready to do the show, I had everything on my list done. But I mean, before that, I was really uptight about it, you know, and sometimes there's a lot of things that are like that. You look at making a piece that you want to make and you get really uptight about it. And then you need to sometimes tell yourself, you know, you're only making that because those are your criteria. If you don't do part of it and it still looks good, no one else is going to know but you.
Do you remember that outfit you made that was a replica of you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My self-portrait. Yeah, I still have that. It's pretty cool. I did an art show down here at the General Morgan Inn. They have a gallery in the General Morgan Inn, and every 6 weeks they let a new person, you know, do a show over there. And I've done one over there now. And I took that over there and set it up, and people really got a big kick out of it. It's this big, tall wooden box with doors on the front of it that inside the box there's a pair of bib overalls and with a flannel shirt underneath them hanging on a hanger inside the box. And there's a white cane in the box and there's a click rule in the pocket. And then up on top of the box, there's a straw hat, an old beat up straw hat stapled to the top of the box. And then underneath the bottom of the box sitting on the floor is a pair of steel toed boots with the toes, the leather's all worn off. So the steel's showing through on the toes. It's a great self-portrait. Jeff, that was the only thing that was required in that show when I did it, was you had to have a self-portrait of some type.
And that was you.
That was me, yeah.
Well, George, I want to thank you for being on the call. Thanks again, and see you next month.
I'm out of beer, so I gotta go.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Jeff.
Be sure to check out www4b.org, Woodworkers for the Blind. Become part of the community and learn from others. Hope you enjoyed, and until next time, bye-bye.